I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Earthquakes in the central U.S. have been steadily increasing, and both fuel extraction and wastewater disposal link to the issue. Today we'll learn the long-term implications of tremors in the heartland and speak with a scientist who says strategies exist to mitigate the problem. Then meet the man who's worked for years to bridge Washington's partisan divide and reunite the country's leaders, but he's had limited success. We'll find out why one veteran mediator still holds out hope. This week's State House Blend will wrap up the program. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Is it just me, or have you noticed more news reports of earthquakes in recent years? Maybe it's no surprise, but it turns out that earthquakes in the heartland have been steadily increasing. How we extract oil, gas, and dispose of our wastewater are all linked to the issue. There are things we can do to get a handle on all this, and that's our first topic here this morning. With us is Dr. Heather Deshaun. She's an associate professor of geophysics and a seismologist who has studied earthquakes at Southern Methodist University. She's in town to speak about this tonight up at Park University. And Heather, nice to have you. Welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's always great to be back in Kansas City.
Oh, that's great. I've heard you say that the number of earthquakes in some places in the heartland here actually exceeds averages in California. And California, of course, is a state that most people associate with earthquakes. What are you seeing out there?
Yes. So back in the 2015-16 time period, the seismicity rates in Oklahoma had, in fact, exceeded California. Oklahoma has made regulatory changes to the amount of wastewater allowed to be put into the subsurface, and they have started to see decreased seismicity rates in response to that over the more recent time period.
And through regulation, you can actually control the number of earthquakes that take place in a defined area?
Yeah, so the earthquakes in Oklahoma and parts of Kansas and in my area of the world down in the Dallas-Fort Worth area have been linked to a process called wastewater injection. And mm-hmm. this process puts large volumes of wastewater deep into the earth, into rock layers that have space for those waters, and in fact, layers of the earth that actually already have very salty, briny waters within them. And that has set up pressure fronts within those subsurface layers that when those pressure changes interact with pre-existing ancient faults have started to generate earthquakes in these areas.
I thought the earth down below us was solid, and what you're suggesting is something very different.
So the earth is solid, but
That's good. I'm glad to hear that. Yes.
Of course. I mean, the crust that we're talking about is, of course, solid rock, but rocks have, and the minerals within the rocks, have space that can store fluids, right? So you can think of some rock layers, depending on their history, as storing our ancient seas, for example. So some rocks, like limestones, which you're very familiar with here in Missouri, have a lot of pore space for fluids to be stored.
I mean, there's space between the cracks, there's cavities,
that's right,
and water can be injected and stay down
that's
there.
That's right. In fact, in general, both in North Texas and in Oklahoma, the operators are actually putting the wastewater into these layers that have so much available space that gravity alone can push the water into these layers.
I'm so confused on a basic point here.
Okay.
When you talk about injecting wastewater into the earth, wastewater from what? This isn't from our toilets, right? This is something else.
That's right.
Yeah.
So there are actually many sources of the wastewater. One source in North Texas is the water that comes out with shale gas. So it's the It's the water used to hydrofracture on horizontally drilled wells to extract mm-hmm. shale gas, mm-hmm. but it's also the water that was naturally in the rock units as that comes out with the gas.
So in the process of extracting the gas, then water is pulled out of the earth and then it's dumped back in. It's yeah. shot back in, maybe is a better way to put
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that's right. So in North Texas, the area I'm most familiar with, most of the wastewater is related to extraction of shale gas out of what we call the Barnett Shale.
Mm-hmm.
In Oklahoma, it's a little bit different. When oil prices were very high, it was economical to pull oil out of units that were full of water. So either through enhanced oil recovery or naturally. And there was no hydrofracking involved in this at all. It's just that the oil that was produced and the gas that was produced out of these layers came with a lot of natural water. Now, this is not water that has any sort of surface use, right?
Right.
These waters are
polluted water.
Yeah, these waters
toxic.
Yeah, these deep waters that come out of these units are saltier than seawater. They have a lot of radioactive elements. They've sat in the earth for a very long time,
mm-hmm.
and so they cannot be easily recycled and used even for irrigation purposes. So it makes the most sense to re-inject them into the subsurface.
So Heather, is this process, these processes you're describing, these are different than fracking? Is fracking a different kind of thing?
That's right. So fracking, we draw a line in the science community between fracking and wastewater disposal. So fracking is the process of putting high-pressured water into a rock unit to essentially create little fractures and open up space for the gas to come out.
I see.
So fracking has existed for a very long time. The process of the technology for fracking dates to the late 1940s, 1950s.
Huh.
The technological development was, in fact, horizontal drilling combined with hydrofracturing to produce shale gas. And that really kicked off the U.S. Natural gas
Yeah.
Boom.
So the distinction here is that when you're dumping wastewater back into the earth, you're not trying to extract anything. You're just dumping it back.
That's
Whereas
right.
fracking, you have an ulterior motive, which is you're trying to extract gas or oil in the process of injecting water at very high pressure rates under the earth then.
Yeah, that's
okay.
correct.
But both these the problem we have here is that both these processes can result in earthquakes.
Yeah, that's right. Hydrofracking, the actual process of fracking, that energy can transfer over to known faults and cause earthquakes. Now, this has happened in Ohio. This has happened in Canada. This is not generally the primary concern in Oklahoma and Kansas, though.
Why not?
Well, in Oklahoma and Kansas, the earthquakes seem to be more directly linked to the wastewater injection rather than the process of hydrofracking.
And that's going to surprise people because we've done shows here, interviews with folks, and we've talked about this idea that it's fracking that's causing the quakes that we've even experienced up here in Kansas City. But you're saying, again, no, it's from a different process of dumping the wastewater back in.
Yeah, you know, there are many processes that can trigger earthquakes on known faults, and it is a bit of a myth that all of the wastewater is due to hydrofracking, particularly in Oklahoma and Kansas.
Well, so how big of a problem do we have? I guess our area, our listenership is more concerned with Kansas. How big of an issue do we have here with these earthquakes occurring more often and what that might mean down the road?
So one distinction that I like to make and one of the talking points for this evening's lecture at Park University is that regardless of cause, once you start having earthquakes, your hazard increases. So
that's one of your main points here. You start these things, look out, they're going to keep coming.
That's right. So, you know, there's two avenues. We are, as scientists, very interested in cause because we need to understand the physics of the processes in the subsurface to have any hope of providing information that would help public policy for management or mitigation purposes. On the other hand, once you start to have earthquakes, your earthquake hazard increases. So the U.S. Geological Survey has started to issue one-year hazard forecasts for the central and eastern U.S. so that local populations and emergency managers can understand the probability that their town or or their state would experience damaging shaking over the next year. Finally, from a kind of public perspective, you know, I went to high school and junior high in Missouri. We worried mostly about the New Madrid seismic zone.
I was going to ask you about
we're
that.
We're not really prepared or trained from the time we're small children to know what to do in an earthquake. So there's also just a public education component to the problem. You need to have people actually understand their statistical probability of feeling shaking and then know what to do, or if they're in southern Kansas, like know how to strap down their water heaters or take the small steps that can make a big difference during earthquakes.
So many questions here. Is it possible that the shaking that we're experiencing in Kansas and Oklahoma, can that begin to encourage a bigger quake along the New Madrid fault line? Do those things begin to connect in some way?
I wouldn't go that far. The New Madrid system is in eastern Missouri, right? Eastern Arkansas, Tennessee, Kentucky area.
So it's a far away.
It's far away. It's in a geologically different setting. New Madrid is an area or a seismic zone where natural earthquakes have taken place for hundreds of years. Obviously, people around here are probably most familiar with the earthquakes in 1811 and 1812.
Right.
But the geology changes and the crust has been bent and sunk and folded up significantly between the New Madrid area and Oklahoma in particular. Now, there are little pockets of Arkansas where they were doing wastewater injection, where Arkansas also had some induced earthquakes, but that state reacted pretty aggressively in putting regulations in place to decrease the volumes.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about the possibility of earthquakes in our area and in Kansas as a result of fracking and wastewater injection. I'm visiting with Dr. Heather Deshaun, who's an associate professor of geophysics and a seismologist at SMU. She'll be speaking this evening at 7. You've heard her refer to this at Park University up in Parkville about the increase in earthquakes in the central states. More information about this at Park University's website. And if you want to join our conversation right now, that number 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Now, explain to me again, Heather, why is it that once you begin to have some earthquake activity in southern Kansas and Oklahoma, that can lead to more earthquakes down the road? What's happening down there that might cause that?
All of the faults that appear to have been triggered or reactivated over the last few years are faults that had leftover stored energy on them that were already close to failure. So once you generate a big earthquake, say the magnitude 5.8 Pawnee earthquake that occurred in September of last year, the earthquakes themselves can perturb the stress on surrounding faults. I mean, a large earthquake is always going to have aftershocks. So stress perturbation due to earthquakes is, in fact, well-known, well-documented, and is why we have aftershocks in the first place.
And the severity potential, does that go up as well?
So this is a good question. One of the things we don't understand about the faults in Oklahoma, Kansas, and North Texas, the ones that have been reactivated, is we don't understand how much stress is left over down there, how much energy, really, elastic energy, how much energy is left on these faults. And since we don't understand that, we don't yet have a really good understanding of how big the earthquakes can be. So in Oklahoma, we've seen increasing magnitude earthquakes over time.
There's no question about that. They are getting more severe with time.
So what has happened in Oklahoma is with reductions in volumes. They've seen reduction in overall earthquake rate, but then the magnitude 5.8 earthquake occurred. So the total amount of energy that's released in the earthquakes has actually gotten bigger because some of these larger earthquakes have happened. And
that's scary.
Well, I wouldn't say scary, but I would say it's something for people to be aware of. So certainly one of the things that we pay attention to is even if the rate of smaller magnitude earthquakes has started to decrease, you still need to be aware that larger earthquakes can occur and the populations should still be prepared to deal or experience shaking.
So people need to be on point here. They need to be aware of the potential here and things they might begin to think about doing to prepare for that.
That's right. I would say that we have made huge inroads in understanding what is causing the earthquakes in the central, the earthquake rate changes in the central and eastern U.S. over the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
But we have not yet solved the problem to the point where the population still shouldn't be prepared to experience earthquake shaking.
Okay, our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Earthquakes in the heartland is our topic. Let's go to Mike from South Kansas City. Mike, you're on the program.
Okay. My question is, where does the water come from that they frack with? Meaning, is it good water or is it crap water that came out of the ground already? You know what I mean? Are we destroying good water in the fracking process?
Good question. Thanks, Mike.
So my understanding, and this is not my area of expertise, is that the water that is used for hydrofracking is not necessarily being drawn from our aquifers that are used for our drinking water, and they do try not to ruin good water.
Mm-hmm.
It does take a lot of water, though, to hydrofrack.
Mm-hmm. A whole lot of water, right?
That's right,
a whole lot of water. Well, how do you guys know this stuff about what's going on underneath the earth and stress levels and tensions and all these things? How can you possibly know these things?
So some of the information is hard to get, but I'll tell you what I do as a seismologist. So as a seismologist, when we have earthquakes begin, we put out local seismic networks. These are seismometers are incredibly sensitive instruments.
And they're on the surface of the earth.
Yeah, so we put them in the surface, or you can put them down boreholes, but you certainly don't put them down around where the earthquakes are occurring. So we are keeping them up at the surface or nearer the surface. So these record the earthquakes. Earthquakes generate different kinds of body waves. They travel at different speeds.
Mm-hmm.
So when an earthquake initially starts, there's a primary wave that goes out and it makes the earth move in certain ways, and it propagates much like a sound wave, and that will show up on instruments one way. And then the second wave that gets generated is called the secondary wave or the shear wave, and that literally makes the particles in the earth move in a different way. And then we use that information to back out where the earthquake occurred, how big it was, what is the velocities of the subsurface, just based on how fast those waves traveled to any of the stations. And then you can start to map out the subsurface in that way. Another way the surface has already been mapped out is that in order to place wells in good locations, either production wells or wastewater injection wells, the industry has spent a lot of time making explosions or shaking the earth with trucks in order to do the same thing, use how the seismic waves bounce and reflect and refract off of the different rock layers in order to understand, you know, where the shales are versus where the limestones are, to image where the oil is so that they can most efficiently go and extract that. And so that sort of work also reveals where faults are at And then everybody needs to work together, academic scientists, federal scientists, regulators, oil and gas industry scientists, to put all of our different data together to make forward scientific progress on this matter.
You know, Heather, you're so articulate about this, and you explained that so well. I just want you to know how much I appreciated it, because you just did a great job. And again, to point out, Dr. Heather Deshaun speaks tonight at 7 up at Park University in Parkville. More information on Park University's website. Heather, thanks so much. Really
appreciate
it.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll try to figure out whether Democrats and Republicans will ever be able to work together again out in Washington, D.C. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. We had a great talk yesterday with Brother Guy of the Vatican Observatory. We found out about Fashion Week here in Kansas City. Find those conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow we welcome back Kansas City Mayor Sly James into the studio to talk about the State of the City address he'll give this evening, and we'll look at the proposed 1/8-cent sales tax on the Kansas City, Missouri ballot coming up next week. Well, it may appear that the two major political parties will never get along again. It probably appears to you that the idea is dead and buried, but Mark Gerzon thinks otherwise. He's been involved in efforts to bring the parties together that have actually worked. We're about to find out when that was and if it can possibly ever happen again. Mark Gerzon is president of the Mediators Foundation and is the author of The Reunited States of America, How We Can Bridge the Partisan Divide. And Mark, so good to have you here. Welcome to Kansas City.
Thank you, Steve.
So there's hope out there?
There's hope out there, but we've got some changing to do, Steve.
You think?
Because if we don't change the way we play, the country's going to look like a bad divorce.
So we change the way we play how? Because you're talking about big changes here that probably have to occur.
That's right. I mean, I use the analogy of divorce because most people understand that when mom and dad don't get along, when mom and dad start using the kids for power plays, when mom and dad start lying about each other, when mom and dad start saying that the other's all at fault, we know what happens to the family. People don't need a degree in political science, Steve, to know what that feels like. We all know what that feels like.
Yeah.
Whether our parents divorced or not, whether we've divorced or not, we know what that feels like. And we also know what a couple needs to do to try to repair and revive a relationship. So it's even more challenging in politics, obviously. But I use that analogy so that people don't feel like, oh, that problem's over in Washington. I can't understand it. People can understand it, and we can make a difference.
So what's happening in Washington is like a really, really bitter divorce that's going on.
That's right. And where they can't divorce because they're kind of stuck together. I mean, we don't want a divorce, because what a divorce looks like is basically they're all Republicans in Washington or all Democrats, and that's called fascism or totalitarianism. Then we look like Russia or Iraq, and we're the United States of America, and the United States of America is about democracy. And as I explain in my book, democracy depends on relationship. There is no getting away from relationship in a democracy. And if you can go to the Soviet Union or Russia and Vladimir Putin, if you want to experience what it's like without democracy, it's one party and one ruler. And they've just put the only opposition leader in jail for 15 days. Why? Because they had protests saying there's corruption. So if we want a country like that, you know where to fly to. But if you want to live in a democracy, then you got to say, well, we need to care about relationship. And chapter 2 of my book is all about relationship, which we never talk about.
Well, if I've heard it once, I've heard it a million times, Mark, this idea that the Washington of old, meaning 20, 25, 30 years ago, there were lots of relationships going on there, Democrats and Republicans going out to dinner after a day on the floor, that kind of thing. But you hear it over and over and over again that stuff isn't happening any longer.
That's right. It came undone in the 90s, which is when I designed the retreats for the U.S. Congress. And I was asked to design and facilitate those retreats for literally 220 members of the House. That was the biggest peacetime movement in history.
In Hershey, Pennsylvania.
In Hershey, Pennsylvania. And that was basically them deciding, we need to get a family therapist here. We need to get a couples counselor here, because this isn't working. That was 25 years ago, Steve. And so I saw firsthand the red light. I mean, the other metaphor I use is the red light went on the dashboard of democracy that said, you need oil. And we didn't put oil in. And we haven't put oil in the engine of democracy for 25 years. And what happens to your car if the red light goes on, you don't put oil in? Everybody goes. You know, again, we don't need a degree in political science. You just need to have a car and know what it takes to take care of a car. And so basically what the way I see it is that without oil, you can have the fanciest engine, you can have the coolest wheels, you can have the biggest chassis, but without oil, that car comes grinding to a halt. And they're talking about April 28th shutting down the government again. You know, so here we go again. And it's not a surprise to me because, and what people say, well, Mark, what's oil? What do you mean by oil? It's trust. It's trust and a willingness to work together. And what we've seen literally in the last 6 months is we've seen institution after institution become untrustworthy. Can we trust the FBI? Can we trust the Supreme Court? Can we trust Nunez, you know, commission that's investigating the Russian allegations?
Yeah.
Can we trust the president to speak the truth? Can we trust the media to speak the truth? Suddenly, we don't know who to trust anymore. And that's the prelude to a strong man coming in and saying, well, I've got to take over.
Well, can you reach a point in the scenario you just laid out here where it's too late, where you can't get it back? You can't pull us back from the brink because there's no trust anywhere.
There is a point, and I've worked for the United Nations. After I did the work with Congress, I was hired by the United Nations to go to countries around the world that were having crises, like Nepal, which had a democratic crisis, and Kenya, which had a crisis in violence. And basically what happens when things go too far is you see more and more violence, and you see a militarization of the community, like we're seeing a militarization on the border, and we're seeing a militarization in a number of parts of our culture. And then you know that you've kind of gone over the brink. And then what often happens is that violence happens and people get scared and they go, oh, no, because of this violence, we have to fix things. My hope is the United States won't have to go to that state because we're a strong, vibrant democracy with really good institutions and really good people. So my hope is we never have to go through that spasm of violence. But in the countries that I've worked in, that's what happens next is you have some violence and it either gets worse or people get scared and they say, oh, we've got to fix this.
Mark Gerzon is my guest. He's president of the Mediators Foundation and is the author of The Reunited States of America, How We Can Bridge the Partisan Divide. Take us back to, I think it was 1996, Hershey, Pennsylvania. How did that retreat come about, and why haven't we seen one in the years since?
It came about because a Democrat turned to a Republican and said, this isn't working anymore. And the Republican colleagues said, no, this is crazy. We can't get the people's business done anymore. The two of them then turned to two more, and the four of them turned to four more. And then the eight of them wrote a letter to every member of the House that said, we need to fix Congress. Let's have a retreat. Let's have the Speaker and the Minority Leader authorize that. Please sign this, and let's have a retreat. And so it was a grassroots movement of members of Congress. That letter was then signed by like 90 members of Congress. And that's what led to the retreat. And the retreat diagnosed the problems and made very clear what the solutions were. And this is what I want your listeners to understand. They analyzed it beautifully. They analyzed it better than anybody, any columnist, any pundit has ever done. And they then had these recommendations, which they took back to Capitol Hill on Tuesday morning. And you know what happened next? The Speaker of the House, who was a Republican, Newt Gingrich, and the Democratic leader, who was Dick Gephardt from Missouri, they said, hey, we can't let these things happen. They're challenging our control as the leader of these two parties. So they killed all the recommendations because the party leaders want to keep in control. And that's why, you know, I and so many other organizations and so many other people today, why we're saying this, there's a two-party duopoly and the American citizens really have to reclaim their country. It's not about being a Republican or a Democrat as the solution. It's about challenging both the Democrats and Republicans to open up the political system so that citizens can be heard again.
How would you recommend that the average citizen listening to this go about doing what you just said, Mark?
Well, what I love about the experience of writing this book, The Reunited States of America, is that I profiled 40 organizations that are doing just that. So a listener who says, gee, I want to do something, you can literally go to the pages of the book and find 40 organizations, including some right here in Kansas City.
I was going to say.
Yeah, including some right here in
American Public Square.
American Public Square is a good example. Get involved in one of these 40 organizations because they are part of the solution. And there's absolutely no reason why ordinary citizens can't start saying, hey, I don't have to live in a red box or a blue box. I'm not a politician. I'm free. Mm-hmm. We fought for our freedom in 1776. We didn't fight for our freedom to live in a red or blue box. Mm-hmm. We fought to be free men and women. So we can exercise that freedom. And I want to say something about the first chapter. The second chapter of my book is about relationship, but the first is about learning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the first thing a citizen can do is they can say, I don't have to buy into this pro-con left-right thing. I can actually ask myself, what do I think about healthcare? What do I think about the border? And I guarantee you, if you do your own research, you won't end up in a red or blue box.
Mm-hmm.
Because the red and blue boxes, on almost every issue, they've taken the truth and they've cut it in half. Or if not in half, in a quarter and three quarters.
Mm-hmm.
They've cut the truth apart and they've each taken control of a part of it. So what a citizen has to do is they've got to analyze those and say, what do I feel and how do I stand for what I believe?
Is that this idea of taking a transpartisan vacation that you suggest in the book?
That's right.
That's your first recommendation in the book.
It is. What I mean by that is, let's say you're a liberal listening to this program or a conservative. I'm saying take a vacation for a couple of weeks, just like you would if you were taking a vacation to the Caribbean or something.
Mm-hmm.
Take a vacation from being a liberal or conservative and read other things and do other things and talk to other people. Because it's actually having a vacation from who you've been all your life. And then after the vacation, if you want to go back to being who you were before, well, go ahead. But most people, when they go on vacation, I know it's true for me, I learn something. I decide, oh, I really enjoy this, or I like that food, or I want to do more of that. And that's basically what happens on a transpartisan vacation. You say, hey, I don't have to be a cookie-cutter liberal or conservative. It's just not who I am.
I should point out that you can hear Mark Gerzon tonight at 6:30 at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. More information at kclibrary.org. Why didn't the members back in 1996 demand that Dick Gephardt and Newt Gingrich do more with those recommendations, those very wise observations they came up with and recommendations, and push forward with them?
Well, Steve, that's a very important question, and the answer is shocking. What the answer is that there's a large segment of the United States Congress, our elected representatives, that feels powerless. I had a Republican come to me who was high up in the Republican Party and say, Mark, I said, his name was Ray. Ray, why don't you do more of X, Y, and Z? He said, Mark, you don't understand. I'm powerless. And I'm looking at this guy who represented a district in Illinois.
Ray LaHood.
Okay, well, we'll out him then. Ray yeah. LaHood, who, yes, later
well,
became—
Ray in Illinois. I'm getting there pretty quickly.
Okay, so, sorry. Well, Ray LaHood. You know, Ray said, Mark, you don't understand. I'm powerless. And I said, you're powerless? You're a member of the United States Congress, and you're one of the leaders in the Republican Party. He said, no. He said, there's a whole segment of us, a whole group of us here in Congress that are powerless because there's two poles, the left and the right, and they, at that point, were turning against each other. And that's what we've seen, 25 years of turning against each other. And another person pulled me aside at one of the retreats and pulled me aside in the hall and said, Mark, she was a chief of staff. She whispered to me, she said, Mark, we're being told to oppose everything they recommend, and they're being told to oppose everything we recommend. She said, I don't think that's leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And I will never forget that. That was 1996, and that was 25 years ago. And so we've had 25 years of this careening from left to right. And no wonder there's been so many accidents and so little progress. We no longer have somebody who's got their hands on the wheel who's driving us towards a destination like, let's go to the moon.
Yeah.
We now have this careening of two competing hands on the steering wheel, and it's just one long crash.
You know, Mark, you are president, as I've mentioned a couple times, of the Mediators Foundation, and I'm wondering, as president, could you bring the two parties together on an issue like healthcare reform and figure this thing out?
Well, I know exactly how to do it because we've done it. If you give me the power, the answer is yes. But I had the power to do that some years ago with the chiefs of staff from the House and Senate. We took the chiefs of staff off, and the issue then was stimulating the economy, but healthcare could work. And basically what you do is you create these small teams, half and half, you give them problems to solve, and they become partners. And you then create fact-finding groups, and you get fact-finding groups to find absolutely objective answers to various questions, and then they put those answers together and create a policy. The problem we experienced was that they would get all excited because they'd come up with a better policy on these retreats. Then they'd go back to Capitol Hill. And again, the party leaders would say, no, we're not working together with them. Mm. We've got an election coming up and we've got to beat them. So we're going to use this issue to beat them at the polls. And that's why I say in the book, we've become an endless campaign. We no longer have governing. We live in an endless campaign. And that's why we need the citizens who are listening to this program. That's why we need citizens, because our politicians have gotten caught in the red and blue boxes.
Again, so many citizens are so turned off by what they're seeing out there, they've retreated back into their houses and said, forget it, I'm not messing with that stuff. Right. And that's a problem, too.
It is, because when citizens retreat into their houses, we start to look like Russia. We start to look like these places where we're afraid to go into the public square. And that's why rescuing the public square from the tyrants on the right and the left is so important.
Your step two in terms of solutions for all this is to recognize and exercise your liberty to learn, meaning?
Meaning that most people think that being a citizen, like just take the issue of healthcare, are you for Obamacare or against Obamacare? People think they're supposed to have an opinion on that.
Mm-hmm.
I say to them, no, you're not supposed to have an opinion on that. Just like with the Brexit debate, the choice was remain or leave. Well, you know, take a marriage again. What if you went to your wife or your husband and said, your choice in this marriage is to remain or leave? Well, that's not a choice.
Mm-hmm.
That's an ultimatum.
Mm-hmm.
No, let's work on this relationship and make it better. So take health care. I think you get a wide consensus of Democrats and Republicans that Obamacare isn't perfect. Obamacare needs to be improved. And let's improve it. But instead of improving it, they're playing this game of cat and mouse now. And so for me, learning means how do I, as a citizen, find my opinion about something that's not caught in this pro-con, right-left? Mm-hmm. That's not the truth. That's never the truth, you know? Do you want a wall or don't you want a wall? I mean, all these are false choices, and they're political games. And we're told that to be a citizen means playing the politician's political game. And I argue the first responsibility of a citizen, and Thomas Jefferson would agree, is to learn.
Hmm. And then figure it out before you start having to make a choice you're
That's
not prepared
right.
to make.
The other way I say it is take stock before you take sides. Take stock before you take sides.
You also suggest that people identify and support leaders who are reuniting America. I mean, are there people out there who are reuniting America?
Yes. They're not always called independents. But I would look at who is calling themselves an independent and why. 43% of Americans call themselves independents. That's more than the Democrats and more than the Republicans. Yet when you pick up the newspaper, you never hear about those 43%. Never. You always hear about the 32% Republicans and the 26%, the parties. That's a complete violation of democracy. There's 40% of Americans that are independents.
Mark Gerzon's book is The Reunited States of America, How We Can Bridge the Partisan Divide. Again, you can see and hear him tonight at 6:30 at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. Interesting stuff. Mark, appreciate it very much.
Good to be with you, Steve.
It's time now for State House Blend. This week, we're on the Kansas side of the state line with Republican Representative Melissa Rooker. She joined host Sam Zeff and reporter Barb Shelley to talk about a new school funding formula and the budget.
Why don't we start with school finance, Melissa? And, you know, I know that there's been a lot of action going on, and, you know, Superintendent Hinson proposed a plan that you didn't like, and then there's another plan on the table. Can you kind of pull all the pieces together for us and tell us where we are right now?
Sure. So school finance in the House is it has been undertaken by a special committee that the speaker stood up. It's the K-12 Budget Committee, 17-member House committee new this year, and our focus, our primary mission, is to work out a plan to propose to our colleagues that provides a new funding formula. So we've spent time since the beginning of session having informational hearings and taking in the kind of data and just crafting the basic level of understanding among committee members to be able to start making decisions. Those of us that brought forward bill drafts that had proposals for new school funding plans introduced them, and each one was given its own day in court, so to speak. Well, maybe that's a bad analogy, but public hearings.
Yeah, nobody wants to talk about court and school finance about that.
No, we had public hearings on each of the formulas introduced, and there was a big difference between several of the plans. So we aired out those issues through a public vetting process and have had plenty of time to examine those plans. with all of the information gathering, the chairman of the committee has created, he's brought forth what is being called the chairman's bill draft. It is a vehicle to serve as the basis for the formula that the House brings to the floor. And we've had 2 days of hearings on that bill draft, a third scheduled for Monday, and then the committee will get to work. And the work will involve bringing amendments and having discussion as a committee about what elements we like, what we want to change, what we want to add, what we want to subtract, and ultimately get to the goal of having a funding plan.
I want to talk about just how much the chairman's bill puts in or suggests that goes in there. Chairman Larry Campbell, who is a representative from Olathe, he's proposed $75 million new dollars to put into public education. And I don't think there's anybody in the legislature, maybe not even him, who believes that's enough money to satisfy the state Supreme Court.
Oh, I think there are people who think that would be enough. I think there are people who think that we don't need to put any new dollars in. We should rearrange what we're doing. But even I would agree, Chairman Campbell knows it's just a starting point. He's repeatedly said that. I definitely don't agree that that's sufficient funding. I do think that it's realistic to phase in funding over a period of a certain a number of years, whether, you know, somewhere in the range of 3 to 5 years, I think is the expectation people should have. We're not going to come up with a massive sum of money all at once. Even if we could, schools need time to implement programs and hire staff and make the plans to spend those dollars. So right up front, a big, bold infusion of cash like that would not actually be spendable all at once. So they need a little time to put their programs in place and rebuild their staff levels. And so I think we can phase in funding. I do think that the goal is very clearly defined in the lawsuit. There is a lot of time in the opinion spent pointing to the only cost study that we have to refer back to. It was done in 2005. So even without accounting for inflation and its effect, we fall but somewhere between I think it's $600 to $800 million short of where that cost study says we should have been 12 years ago. So to me, it's unrealistic to think that we'll satisfy things and do right by our children, which I remind people that's what this is all about, is making sure our children have the appropriate opportunities. It will take significant money, but so over time, I think the goal needs to be in the neighborhood of $700 or $800 million.
Well, I'm just, you know, you're doing this against a backdrop of, another overwhelming budget gap for the budget you're trying to develop for the next 2 years, and I'm just wondering, you know, I actually. I'm surprised at how positive and resolute you sound, because I think I would want to run and hide in a closet with all these problems. But so how does that play into it?
We can do this. We have the capacity to solve these problems. We've crafted some remedies. We've taken some very difficult votes, but we've done the work that we are called upon to do, which is to solve the math problem. The state has a budget that, you know, we have cut 9 times over a course of the last few years in order to try and meet declining revenues. We're not overlooking reining in spending and shrinking government. We've reduced the government employee roster by thousands of people. We have maintained a lot of lids on growth in spending. But even with the efficiency study that was done last year, a lot of the recommendations involve investment in order to become more efficient. We can't use old, outmoded computer programs and equipment and expect to be able to crunch data the way it should be crunched to be more effective and efficient for all sorts of government functions. When we're paying mandatory overtime to staff prisons and state mental hospitals and the kinds of institutions that the state is responsible for operating that cannot go on with open shifts, but we have such staffing shortages, then, you know, we're stepping over savings because we can't do anything other than that. We have had you talk to any of my colleagues that serve in any capacity on budget committees, appropriations, ways and means, or any of the subcommittees on budget, every last one of us has spent the session listening to agency after agency across the spectrum come in to talk about the dire fiscal circumstances and the effects those are having. I truly believe people's lives are hanging in the balance for our lack of action.
You're talking about people who would use state hospitals, people
foster care. The DCF is down 463 state employees, short of what they need to do the appropriate inspections of the placement of our foster children. And we have actually had serious incidents. We've had fatalities within that system. And I think the investigations are uncovering really, really disturbing facts about, you know, what should have happened that didn't. We've had, you know, there was an attack at Osawatomie that led to the decertification. A staffer was assaulted by a patient. Safety, public safety is on the line in a lot of ways.
Well, we still haven't, and while they've made up a few troopers in the Kansas Highway Patrol, they're still below staff. Kansas Bureau of Investigation is short investigators.
There's a backlog of investigations that they can't get to in a timely manner. I mean, it just, the list goes on and on. So we always talk about schools and their funding, but, you know, the mental health safety net is in tatters. We have people who should be receiving treatment who are instead incarcerated not because that's where they belong, but it's because law enforcement picks them up and they're in crisis and can't go home, so they've got to go somewhere. But we don't have the facilities to house them where they can get the proper mental health treatment.
Well, that would segue into Medicaid expansion, wouldn't it? Because if you would expand Medicaid, that would pick up a lot of the mental health costs.
Sure, and I voted to do just that this year. The House passed that bill. I'm pleased to say the Senate will have their debate on, I think it's scheduled Monday, and they very likely will also pass the bill, and then it's on the governor.
Barb Shelley, my KCUR bunkie, and also at The Pitch, thanks for being here. Always a pleasure. Representative Melissa Rooker, Republican from Fairway, this is where we turn State House Blend over to you. In the past, you've picked Trouble from The Music Man, and there's got to be a morning after from The Poseidon Adventure as your walk-off tune. Where are you today?
I Told You So by Randy Travis.
A completely different tact, and I couldn't love it anymore. State House Blend Kansas is produced by Matt Hodad. I'm Sam Zeff. I'll see you around the radio.
Suppose I called you up tonight and told you that I love you. And suppose I said I want to come back home. And suppose I cried and said I think I finally learned my lesson. And I'm tired of spending all my time alone. If I told you that I realize you're all I ever wanted, and it's killing me to be so far away.
That was just a section of State House Blend Kansas, KCUR 89.3's podcast about Kansas politics. You can find full episodes by subscribing on iTunes, NPR One, or wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow, Kansas City, Missouri Mayor Sly James. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tatacoro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.
Someday you come crawling back and asking me to take you.